Give corporations a break already. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump wants to lower U.S. business taxes. This economist says other nations are way out in front.
Other countries are not trying to finance their governments with business taxes. They do have business taxes, but it's a small portion of their revenues.
Also, why Coke and Pepsi are spending millions to improve the water supply in Monterrey, Mexico.
Because we rely on the aquifers for our supply of water. If we're not taking care of those aquifers, we will not have access to the resources.
Plus, the endangered rhino in Kenya looking for a mate on Tinder. We ask a close acquaintance to tell us about him.
So he's old, slightly cantankerous occasionally, and we know each other well.
That's all ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Thank you for being here today. Saturday will mark Donald Trump's 100th day in office, and he continues to push ahead on a number of his signature promises. Rolling back environmental protections has been a big one. We'll get to that later today in the show. Also, slashing foreign aid, a move which we'll examine in a few minutes. But let's start with Trump's tax plan, which was unveiled today by Trump's economic team. Here's Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin.
This is going to be the biggest tax cut and the largest tax reform in the history of our country.
Okay, let's take the tax story beyond U.S. borders. Compared to other countries, what might a fair tax plan in the U.S. look like? And what are other countries doing that could possibly work here? James Hines has some ideas. He teaches public finance at the University of Michigan. So the big headline today, James, is that Trump wants to lower corporate tax rates from 35 down to 15%. And he's certainly not the first person to suggest bringing down our corporate taxes. How does our corporate tax rate compare to the rest of the world?
Oh, we're incredibly high. By some calculations, we have the highest tax rate in the world right now.
And why are corporate taxes in the U.S. so high?
We lowered the corporate tax rate in 1986 and then slightly increased it in 1993, but just haven't touched it since then, and that was a long time ago. In the meantime, the rest of the world, including all the countries around us, has cut their corporate taxes a lot.
And so how are they able to afford to have such a low corporate tax?
They get more of their revenue from other sources, of course. In particular, every other country has a value-added tax.
Explain the value-added tax, or VAT, that some people who've traveled overseas have noticed on certain products.
A VAT is really kind of a smart way of doing a sales tax. It's a very efficient and effective way of raising revenue. More than 170 countries currently have value-added taxes. Really, the United States is the only country that doesn't.
Would a VAT ever pass Congress?
It doesn't seem likely in the short run. The problem that the VAT runs into politically is that Democrats think it's not progressive enough because it doesn't put extra burdens on higher income people the way an income tax does. And Republicans worry that it's too easy for the government to raise money with one.
Why is it problematic for the government to raise money?
Because advocates of small government prefer that it be painful and difficult to raise taxes because that puts a natural brake on how much people want to spend.
I mean, that comes right down to the whole debate over taxation in the first place, isn't it?
Look, it's not that complicated. If you want to spend money, you have to raise it with taxes. I get that people don't like the taxes, but then you got to live with smaller spending. That's really your choice.
Are there any other policies, you know, aside from value-added tax that you've been seeing in other countries, any other ways of increasing tax revenue that might work here in the U.S.?
You know, lowering the corporate tax really is a good idea because U.S. corporations are heavily burdened compared to other countries. We can talk till we're blue about wouldn't it be nice if other countries tax their corporations heavily also, but the fact is they don't.
For American corporations, are any of their taxes offset at all by write-offs and loopholes?
Oh, of course. There's plenty of that. I mean, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that we still collect a heck of a lot of corporate tax revenue. You know, it depends on the year, but we're running at about $350 billion a year in collections. So we still collect a lot of revenue, and we still impose a pretty substantial burden on U.S. companies. When you compare us to other countries and what they're doing, we're still kind of behind the eight ball right now.
I don't get that. Why we're doing all this stuff and yet we can't hang on to the revenue?
Other countries are not trying to finance their governments with business taxes. They do have business taxes, but it's a small portion of their revenues. And if you try to cling on to having a lot of revenue that way when other countries aren't doing it, then it puts you in a very uncompetitive situation.
James Hines, a professor of economics at the University of Michigan, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Foreign aid hasn't gotten as much attention as, say, Trump's border wall, but in the president's first 100 days, foreign aid has gone on the White House chopping block. A 15-page internal budget document obtained by Foreign Policy magazine details a White House plan to slash aid to developing countries. Also in those documents, a proposal to merge the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, with the State Department. It got us asking, how much does the Trump White House care about the rest of the world? We wanted answers from both a Democrat and a Republican. We start with Gail Smith, who ran USAID under President Barack Obama. She says the cuts would be short-sighted.
To give up or severely weaken a capability to step back from our leadership on the global stage and to do anything that would cause people around the world to think maybe America isn't there for us anymore is something that some people may think is cost-effective in the short term, but I am absolutely confident that if you did the cost-benefit analysis, this is a very, very expensive proposal.
Do you think the Trump White House wants to help the rest of the world?
I'm not sure. I think it remains to be seen. I think we have yet to see whether or not there's going to be either a deep understanding of development in the Trump administration or a champion for it. Oftentimes, it's hard for people to understand that by helping other people, we also do a lot for ourselves. And if you go back to JFK and when he created USAID, it was about enlightened self-interest rooted in large measure in the expression of our values. It matters that people around the world believe that the United States is out there for them, that we are the beacon of hope, that we will be there in times of need, and we will partner with them. I think that matters.
What is your impression of what Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is thinking?
It's quite frankly, at this point, hard to understand. He has not said that much. He did in his confirmation hearing speak to the importance of development. And while I do understand that one of his interests may be greater efficiencies, that's totally fair. As a responsible public servant, any of us who have served or are serving now think about that. What strikes me is I don't understand where the analysis comes from. If you look at the way some of these cuts are being made or proposals to cut staff, I think there's a strong argument to be made if you dig down deep that these are actually more costly proposals. If we cut staff at USAID, we will rely more on contractors. That's more expensive.
Gail Smith, a fair number of these programs and offices on the chopping block target global women's issues, issues that Secretary of State Hillary Clinton made a priority. Do you think those programs have been systematically singled out?
I don't know, and I can't claim to know what is behind the logic of the cuts. We know that getting girls into school has huge ripple effects that have everything to do from the rights of those girls to their productivity and their contribution to the national economy. We know that to be true. We know and have known for decades in things like microfinance that when women handle the family finances, they are better spent to greater effect. So there's a lot of evidence out there that shows which of these programs are more effective.
Gail Smith ran USAID under President Barack Obama. She's now the president and CEO of the Anti-Poverty One campaign. Gail, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Marco, for your interest.
Andrew Natsios was at the helm of USAID under President George W. Bush. He says although many Republicans oppose slashing foreign aid and folding USAID into the State Department, change is coming.
There are going to be cuts, but I think they could take a 10% cut in the $30 billion foreign aid program, and it's not going to be catastrophic at all. But a 30% cut would be disastrous, and in fact, the actual budget that came out had 60 and 70% cuts, because what they're trying to do is protect the career service at state and some of the state programs, but there, it appears that they're making disproportionate cuts in aid in order to protect state, which is a mistake.
So what or who is the catalyst behind these cuts? Because it sounds very realpolitik budgeting.
It is the most realpolitik budget I have ever seen, actually. Dr. Kissinger, at the end of the Vietnam War, was given the choice of
Henry
either
Kissinger.
Cutting Henry Kissinger, who was the Secretary of State, and I think one of our great Secretary of State, though very controversial. He was given the choice by the Congress. You either cut AID's budget or cut the State Department's short-term economic security fund. He said, I don't want the State Department aid budget cut, cut AID instead. And the consequence of that was, it took us years to recover, we had 12,000 Foreign Service officers at that time. When I arrived, there were 1,150 left, a 900% reduction. There are 1,800 now. We finally built it back up again, and now they're going to cut it again. It's very frustrating, because the infrastructure of officers is very important to the stability of the program who have technical expertise. To become an aid officer, you have to have a master's degree or a PhD or a medical degree or a law degree in development, or you can't be in the Foreign Service. In the State Department, all you need is an undergraduate degree because they train you and they're generalists. AID are specialists, state are generalists.
So who is providing advice to the Trump White House on how to rearrange USAID?
Well, it appears to be some people who were seconded from the Congress, congressional staffers, who are on Rex Tillerson's staff. He, you know, he was an ExxonMobil executive for his entire career. I'm not blaming him. He appears to have gravitas. He's a thoughtful guy, but he does not know anything about AID from what I can tell, because the cuts that were made appear really erratic and don't make any sense to me strategically. They're planning on closing 30 of the U.S. AID missions in the field. Of the 80 missions we have, 30 of them will close, which is a huge number. The other thing that they've done is they've cut some of the most popular programs that have bipartisan support across the spectrum, even from the far right. For example, the disaster response program of USAID was cut 67%. So it deals with civil wars, famines, fragile states, and failed states. It's dealing with Syria on a massive scale, Iraq, South Sudan, Somalia. That was cut 67%. I'm just stunned by that.
There's also another interesting little block, the Evangelical Christians, a constituency that has the ear of the White House. Where do they stand on slashing foreign aid?
Yeah, I was the vice president of Rural Vision, the largest evangelical NGO in the world, $3 billion a year, 40,000 employees in 100 countries. The NGOs that I've talked to in the Evangelical Committee and the Roman Catholic Community are very upset by these cuts. They, I believe, are going to speak out. And that constituency helped elect President Trump. And I'm hoping he will listen to them when they tell him that this is not what they voted for last November.
President George W. Bush gave the Pentagon authority over billions of dollars of development aid during your tenure at USAID. Do you think we're seeing just a similar shift now?
No. One of our biggest supporters is the National Security Advisor, General McMaster. And Jim Mattis, who's the Secretary of Defense, is a very big supporter of state and AID. I'll tell you the other potential ally we have. I am told that Ivanka Trump and her husband, Jared Kushner, are supporters of foreign assistance and want a focus on this. And we are hoping that they will get involved in this discussion because they're very influential with the president. The president really does not know much, and nor did he say much in the campaign about foreign aid.
Yeah, but how much foreign assistance would Kushner and Ivanka Trump be able to muster? Do you worry that the Trump White House just doesn't want to help the rest of the world?
My own view is, I know who's on the staff now. That's stabilizing since General Flynn left. And many of those people know very well that we, a great power like the United States, cannot have a destruction of its foreign aid program and be effective in the world. They just can't.
Andrew Natsios was the head of the U.S. Agency for International Development under President George W. Bush. He's now a professor at the Bush School of Government at Texas A&M. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Since the start of Trump's presidency, we've been asking him a question a day on Twitter about everything from national security to women's rights to whether or not he's going to get a dog. You can go to PRI.org to see the latest question for Trump. You can also weigh in with your own questions on Facebook and Twitter using the hashtag 100Days100Qs. That's 100QS as in questions. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with the world. The city of Monterrey in northern Mexico is the industrial hub of the country. Some 4 million people call the area home. Now, the city is in a semi-arid region, and that means two big problems with water, either not enough of it or way too much. Fixing the area's infrastructure to deal with both of those realities could cost billions, but an American environmental organization has a cheaper solution, and it's getting some bitter corporate rivals to come together to pay for it. From Monterrey, here's the world's Jason Margolis.
The Santa Catarina River runs right through the center of Monterrey. It's a dry riverbed most of the year. A gully of dirt and grass is surrounded by businesses, factories, and hotels. It's hard to imagine what it looked like 7 years ago, when Hurricane Alex tore through the area.
In 2 days, we had the equivalent of 1 year's rainfall in Monterey.
That's Colin Herron with the environmental organization The Nature Conservancy. Water came gushing down from the jagged mountains that ring the city. 15 people in the area died. Floods destroyed bridges and roads and washed away cars. Zoo animals were swept away and hundreds of schools were damaged. AccuWeather described the city as, quote, beyond recognition.
That water came down and hit the city like a bomb, basically.
Devastating, but also curious. Monterey was hit by a stronger hurricane 22 years before. That one didn't cause nearly as much damage. If you want to understand why, you need to head up into the mountains.
In the 22 years that intervened, the upper watershed here, which serves as a buffer to protect the city normally, had lost a lot of its forest cover.
Trees and plants in the mountains here used to absorb a lot of rainfall, but fires and a pernicious bark beetle laid waste to a lot of them. Other areas were cleared for agriculture and development.
A lot of people have in Monterey have like weekend homes here where they go to get out of the city.
On the way up into the mountains, we stop at a massive dam. The 350-foot-tall Rombe Picos Dam was built 10 years ago. It held back some of the waters during Hurricane Alex, but it can't hold all of the water that can run off during big rains.
The dam is only in a particular channel, and this area is vast. So
the government had a few choices. It could do nothing, take its chances. It could erect a bunch more barriers. That's expensive. Or it could try a cheaper approach that the Nature Conservancy is helping to develop. Replant trees. Herron says with more trees, you don't need so many dams. Trees retain water in the soil, and unlike a dam, a healthy forest does a lot of other things.
It will also be improving air quality and also capturing, sequestering carbon as well.
That helps to fight climate change, which is contributing to bigger storms. Trees also help filter water and replenish the aquifers in a dry area with a growing population. We get back in the truck. The road of dirt and rocks gets far bumpier. Calling it a road is being generous, but at least it's dry.
When Hurricane Alex hit in 2010, this road spent about a week under the water.
After a couple of hours, we reach a tiny community high in the mountains, Ejido Canoas. Santana Arizpe says 30 people live here. They're subsistence farmers. The 61-year-old wears a cowboy hat and a child's Spider-Man backpack. He walks with a cane as we hike up a steep mountainside where we meet another older man swinging a pickaxe to break up the dry soil. His name is Enrique Garcia. Garcia says he wakes up at 6 a.m. and works until 5 p.m. He's planting tiny pine trees and cactus-like agave plants that are just a few inches high. He says he can plant up to 200 a day, and for every one of those, his village earns 20 to 30 cents. Last year, they put 20,000 in the ground, earning about $6,000. It's not much, but Arizpe isn't complaining. He says they can buy food, clothes, and shoes. Now they don't have to rely on relatives in the big city. And those checks they're cashing, they're not coming from the government. They're being written by corporations like FEMSA.
FEMSA is the largest Coca-Cola bottler now in the world.
That's Mariano Montero, director of the FEMSA Foundation. FEMSA has directly contributed $5 million to restore watersheds throughout Latin America. It's in their interest. They're a big water user. It's not just Coke that's ponying up. Pepsi and Heineken are pitching in, too. Montero says they're putting competition aside and jointly bearing the costs.
Because we rely on the aquifers for our supply of water.
Still, I asked Montero, why not wait for the government to pay for a fix?
The problems that we are facing in the 21st century cannot be solved with the paradigms of the 20th century. In the 20th century, we left the government to do a lot of things. And oftentimes we find that it has not been efficient. It has not been the solution for these problems.
But he's not saying corporations can solve these problems alone. The state government of Nueva León is still going to have to do the heavy lifting. I stop at another dam and reservoir with the Nature Conservancy's Colin Heron, where people are picnicking.
Yeah, this is a pretty nice area for people to come to. Some people come here at the weekend.
The Nature Conservancy has raised a few million dollars from corporate sponsors in Monterey for the reforestation projects. Ultimately, they want $50 million to plant perhaps 100 million trees in deforested areas. Heron says the corporate seed money for the current pilot programs can show the government that investments in nature are a wise choice.
So what we're doing with Heineken and Pepsi is really showing the government, hey, this scheme makes perfect sense, and look at the benefits this is providing for the city. Now what we need is for you guys to really put your hand in your pocket and invest in this in a sustainable way.
The Nature Conservancy is doing this type of work in troubled watersheds in 25 locations throughout Latin America and the U.S. It's ultimately offering local governments this, a bargain, using nature and not huge infrastructure projects to replenish groundwater, minimize flood risks, and fight climate change at a fraction of the cost. For The World, Jason Margolis, Monterrey, Mexico.
A quick note now before the break. It's about that shooting last week on the Champs-Élysées in Paris. The gunman killed a Paris policeman before he himself was killed. Yesterday, in a ceremony at Paris police headquarters, there was a moving tribute to that cop, a 37-year-old man named Xavier Jugelet. The eulogy was given by his husband, Étienne Cardiles, and I want you to hear a bit of it.
Lorsque sont parus les premiers messages informant les Parisiens qu'un événement grave était en cours sur les Champs-Élysées et qu'un policier avait perdu la vie, une petite voix m'a dit que c'était toi.
Cardiles said that when he got the first messages that a policeman had been killed on the Champs-Élysées, a little voice told him it was Xavier.
Cette haine, Xavier, je ne l'ai pas parce qu'elle ne te ressemble pas.
Cardiles said he didn't hate the attacker because it wasn't like Xavier, his late partner, to feel that way. Hate is not why Xavier became a policeman, he explained.
Parce que l'intérêt général, le service des autres et la protection de tous faisaient partie de ton éducation et de tes convictions.
Xavier was only about serving the public and protecting everyone. His tolerance, dialogue, and patience were his weapons, Cardiles continued.
L'autre facette de l'homme était un monde de culture.
He also spoke about Xavier's first loves, music, and film.
Cinq séances de cinéma dans une magnifique journée ensoleillée d'août ne te faisaient pas peur.
He'd think nothing of going to a cinema on a sunny August day and watching five films in a row, said Cardiles.
Et pour cette langue, l'anglais, que tu voulais parler à la perfection.
Just a small peek into the life of a man who lost his life last week in the line of duty, or as his husband Étienne Cardiles ended his eulogy.
Cette vie de star, tu la quittes comme une star.
This life that you led like a star, you leave like a star.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. President Trump orders a review of national monuments. That could open up a lot of protected land for mining and drilling, and some in the West would welcome that.
Many of us, especially here in Utah, feel like those monuments have been created with arbitrary borders that don't make any sense for what those monuments are set out to protect.
That story just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. As part of the countdown to his first 100 days in office, President Trump signed another executive order today. This one calls for a review of national monuments designated since 1996. These are protected areas, kind of like national parks, but they're created by presidential proclamation, not by an act of Congress. Today's order is part of the Trump administration's push to open up more federal land to drilling, mining, and other development. The World's environment reporter Carolyn Beeler has more.
President Trump today called the recent creation of national monuments a land grab by the federal government.
Today I'm signing a new executive order to end another egregious abuse of federal power and to give that power back to the states and to the people where it belongs.
The executive order directs Interior Minister Ryan Zinke to review roughly 24 national monuments created over the last two decades under the 1906 Antiquities Act. The goal, Zinke told reporters before the signing, to figure out whether to scrap or shrink certain monuments.
Under President Trump's leadership, I'm looking forward to working with and being an advocate for local, state, and tribal representation, and to review the designations and provide recommendations for action.
Bears Ears Monument in southeastern Utah is one of those up for review. The 1.3 million acre monument was designated late last year by President Obama amid protest from many local elected leaders, including Republican Senator Orrin Hatch, who was at the Interior Ministry today for the signing of the executive order. Tim Young, the mayor of nearby Monticello, Utah, says he's happy the area of the monument might be reduced with this presidential action.
Many of us, especially here in Utah, feel like those monuments have been created with arbitrary borders that don't make any sense for what those monuments are set out to protect.
Designating an area a national monument typically restricts mining and oil and gas development. It also gives the federal government more control over which recreational activities are allowed there. Young says his 1,800-person town is worried about being cut off from some of their favorite places.
We have a lot of people that ride horses in those areas or that run cattle in those areas. And unfortunately, we don't know what's going to happen. Are we going to be able to do the things we've always done here? You know, are our neighbors going to continue to be able to ranch those areas?
The American Petroleum Institute is applauding Trump's executive order, but environmental groups aren't happy that the move might open up previously protected lands to mining and drilling. Brad Sewell is from the Natural Resources Defense Council.
As much as this has been framed as a review, we have every reason to believe anywhere from, 25 to a single monument will be weakened or wholly abolished.
If President Trump does propose substantial changes to existing national monuments, his administration is sure to face legal challenges, Sewell says.
It would be tragic, it would be unprecedented, and it would really amount to a sellout of the American people for a favored few, for commercial industries that want to get back into these places that have been set aside for the benefit of the American public.
Today's announcement at the Interior Ministry is the start of a final environmental policy push before Saturday, when President Trump hits his 100th day in office. Tomorrow, his advisors are set to hash out whether to remain in the Paris Climate Change Agreement. And Friday, Trump is expected to sign another executive order, this one aimed at opening waters in the Atlantic and Arctic Oceans to offshore drilling. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Here's some news for the lovelorn. If you use Tinder and see a handsome devil named Sudan, who describes himself as the most eligible bachelor in the world, and he's looking for love, caveat emptor people, you will go on to find out that Sudan likes to eat grass and chill out in the mud. Sudan is a white rhino, and he's been having trouble finding a mate. We called up Richard Vine in Kenya to find out more about Sudan and why he's so lonely. So, Richard, you run the Ol Pejeta Conservancy in Kenya. What does this particular white rhino look like? How big is he?
So he's a huge animal. He probably weighs somewhere in the region of 5,000 pounds, I think. So, he's a big animal. He's now pretty aged, slightly cantankerous occasionally. He's a very impressive animal, as all of these rhinos are.
Why is he unable or does not want to mate with the white rhino females at your conservation park?
The history of this program is that the northern white rhino went extinct in the wild probably around about 2007. So we hatched a plan with a zoo in the Czech Republic called Dvor Kralovy to bring him and the three other remaining reproductively active animals that were left in the world to Kenya in the hope that in a more natural environment, they could be enticed to breed where they had been unsuccessful in zoo conditions. And they actually showed a lot of mating behavior. Unfortunately, the two females that came out with Sudan didn't get pregnant. So we conducted an examination of them about 3 years later to find through ultrasound that, in fact, they were infertile, probably as a result of their being held in zoo conditions for a long period without having conceived. So actually what we're left with is an infertile old male and two infertile females, which puts this species right on the brink of extinction, as you might imagine.
That sounds like it would be almost impossible to reverse that trend if they're both infertile.
Well, the only way that we can do it is through what are referred to as artificial reproductive techniques. Now, these are commonly practiced in domestic livestock, such as cattle and sheep and obviously humans. But it's never been done in rhinos before. So the challenge is to perfect the technique for rhinos, then to implement it successfully before the two remaining females die, using semen from Sudan, amongst other males, in the hope that we can create embryos for implantation into southern white rhino female surrogates, hopefully then to give birth to purebred northern white rhino calves. So that's what we're embarking on with a team of experts based around the world. It's a tall order for sure. And even if we are successful in getting one or two calves on the ground, that's not enough to save the species. We'll have to do this many times, and then we'll have to set up a system whereby natural breeding can take place to build up hopefully a viable population of animals that one day could be reintroduced back into the wild.
So all this business with Tinder, it's a great shtick, but obviously female white rhinos don't use Tinder. But what's the goal?
For me, there's two goals here. One is to do what I've just explained in terms of recovering this species. It's going to take an enormous amount of money. We're looking to raise, or we think it will cost, between $9 and $10 million to achieve this. And that's the development of the technology and then the actual implementation of that technology. But the second reason for me is that Sudan has become sort of emblematic of the plight that is facing many thousands of species across the planet. If we can use him as a kind of celebrity, for want of a better word, to raise people's awareness about the impact that we humans are having on the planet, as I've said, to many thousands of other species as we speak, that would be something that is worth our while doing. And if our association with Tinder can help us do that in a fun sort of a way, then, you know, we'll be killing two birds with one stone.
What do you reckon Sudan is doing right now? Like, how does he spend his days?
Sudan is a typical sort of old man. He's a little bit slow to get up in the mornings, but he goes out and grazes when it's still cool. And generally not doing a great deal, but I think he's in a pretty happy state of mind.
Richard Vine runs the Old Pajeta Conservancy in Kenya. Good luck with this, and thanks for the interview.
Thanks very much.
Travel bans, crackdowns on sanctuary cities, even a registry for Muslims living in the U.S. President Donald Trump has tried or threatened to try all of those things at various times, either as a candidate or as president. And while some of those efforts are stalled in the courts, the truth is this. Many Muslim Americans are afraid. But then again, they were living in fear well before Trump came on the scene. From San Francisco, here's Levi Bridges.
Google's offices in San Francisco rise above the city's waterfront in a tall brick building. The Bay Area is perhaps the most coveted destination for tech workers from all over the world.
I guess everyone thinks of California as a dream place to live.
31-year-old Sarmad Gilyani is a software engineer here at Google. He says he loves his job. But one morning, something strange happened. Sarmad got a message that two cops were waiting for him in Google's lobby.
So I made a joke to my coworker who sat next to me saying, "Hey, there's these two cops who want to talk to me. Just in case they throw me in Guantanamo, please bail me out."
Sarmad jokes because he's a practicing Muslim. He figured the officers just wanted to talk about an unpaid parking ticket. But this visit was no joke.
So I entered the lobby, and right away, two men in plain clothes, they were wearing suits, approached me, and one of them said he was from the FBI.
Now, you may be thinking, I've heard this story many times before. But this isn't another story about an immigration raid. Sarmad's a U.S. citizen. He grew up rooting for the Houston Rockets. He says he's seen way too many episodes of Law and Order. And he was raised in a Midwestern town with a name straight out of a Simpsons episode. Normal, Illinois. Sarmad says he never felt different until he became an adult. He says every time he got on an airplane, and I mean every time, he got pulled aside for additional screening.
Probably 15 or 20 flights in a row.
The two officers who visited Sarmad at Google said they wanted to talk about his travel problems. But then the subject changed.
One of them asked me how I felt about drone strikes in Pakistan and how awful it must be for the victims. He said, "Well, I understand that you are from Pakistan and you are abreast of the situation there."
Sarmad's never even lived in Pakistan. He only knows his parents' home from occasional trips with his family growing up. Again, he grew up in Illinois. Normal Illinois. More than 1,000 Muslims in the Bay Area, a mix including U.S. citizens and legal permanent residents have also reported the FBI agents or police have showed up to speak with them. Officers are usually fishing for information about terrorism or trying to turn Muslim Americans into informants. This was happening long before President Trump took office. I spoke with Sarmad in the waning days of Barack Obama's presidency. We met again recently at a cafe in Berkeley. So how have things changed under President Trump?
There's an overall sense of fear. It's like you're looking out in the skies and you see the storm clouds coming. That's kind of how it feels.
During the presidential election, Sarmad was featured in an article on Breitbart News about possible terrorists. He had heard of Breitbart, but didn't take this fringe website of the alt-right seriously. But then one of Breitbart's founders, Steve Bannon, became President Trump's chief strategist.
So it's totally conceivable that one day Steve Bannon says, oh, you know, I've already got this list of possible terrorists we need to look at, and my name's going to be front and center. So that is frightening, because you don't know what they're thinking or what they're planning.
Or if the FBI will come visit him again. The FBI and the San Francisco Police Department wouldn't specifically comment for this story. Zara Ballou says the police overstepped their role in asking Sarmad to participate in voluntary questioning.
It's never voluntary when the other person has a gun and a badge.
Ballou is the executive director of the Council on American-Islamic Relations in the Bay Area, an advocacy group for Muslim Americans. She worries that President Trump's campaign promises to increase the surveillance of Muslims might actually fuel terrorism.
We were concerned that the rhetoric that Donald Trump was using to target Muslims was going to be leveraged by ISIS to say that America is at war with Islam.
Sarmad worries about the future of Muslims here in this country, even for U.S. citizens like himself. If Trump actually does create a Muslim registry, he's afraid that the climate will become so hostile, American Muslims might have to leave.
Not because we don't like America, not because we want to leave, but because we feel we are being forced out.
But this country is his home. And he says he has to learn how to feel comfortable here, even though he suspects he's still being watched. For The World, Levi Bridges, San Francisco.
Here's another story with a Pakistan connection. Jalal Baig's mother and father were from Lahore, but decades ago they moved to Chicago, and that's where Jalal Baig was born. He's now a physician, and he occasionally sends us an audio essay like this one.
I recently visited Pakistan after 25 years. Given the long absence, it felt like my first time there. Only faint, scattered images remain from some of my earlier trips. Like much of the world, I only know Pakistan of today through news headlines and the words of hysterical experts. And the consensus among them is clear. Pakistan is the world's most dangerous place. Since 2003, more than 20,000 civilians have died from terrorist violence. And so, when I decided to vacation in Pakistan, my friends and family were puzzled. Though I had concerns, I wanted to go without any expectations or assumptions. I needed Pakistan and its people to reveal themselves to me. My open mind paid dividends. Life is flourishing in Pakistan. Fear has not paralyzed the nation's people. Rickshaws and motorcycles fill the streets. Shops and food stands are bustling. Cricket is played everywhere. And teenagers, just like everywhere else, are seen carrying selfie sticks with the hope to capture that picture-perfect selfie. I met one Pakistani man who lives in Lahore. His name is Afzal. He's a personal driver and is part of the country's working class. When we spoke, I noticed a spark and energy in his words when he talked of Pakistan's resilience. And that resilience comes from Islam. Afzal noted how his religion is sometimes exploited for political reasons. And yet, for many Pakistanis, it has allowed them to live a courageous life. Foreign others aren't blamed here. There's no call for a ban. There's no urge to build walls. Fear hasn't consumed life or humanity in Pakistan. I believe that is Pakistan's greatest lesson for the world.
That was Chicago-based physician Jalal Baig. This next story is about a records office in Sussex, England. I know, real exciting, right? But for two Harvard researchers, this place has yielded historical gold. It's a parchment copy of the Declaration of Independence dating to the 1780s. Danielle Allen and Emily Sneff tracked it down. Allen says it is the find of a lifetime.
It's in beautiful condition. I mean, there are nibbles on the edges that are apparently from a rodent of some sort. We're hoping to test that, actually, like, see if there's any saliva of some kind left there so we can tell what actually ate this document that may be relevant to how it moved from the U.S. to the U.K. But it's very legible. It's much more legible than the copy of the National Archives. The hand used by the clerk, the calligraphy, is clear. am strong. So it's in beautiful shape.
Now, Emily Sneff, you spotted the first clue that this document could exist, might exist. What was that like when you actually had this parchment in your hands and you saw, okay, this is for real?
It was amazing. Every historian hopes to find a piece of the puzzle that no one else has found before that kind of expands the story of our knowledge around certain documents or certain events. So being able to actually see the document in person, to look very closely at it, unlike the signed parchment that's in our national archives, we could hold it. We could hold it right up to our faces and look very closely at the ink, look very closely at those nibbles on the edges that Daniel mentioned. So that's something that you can't do with the signed parchment, which is under glass and in a case that won't be opened for 100 years. So we feel very grateful to have had the opportunity to visit the West Sussex Record Office and see this in person.
Danielle, what are the big differences between this copy that you've discovered and the original that's on display at the National Archives?
The most significant difference has to do with the list of signatories, the names of the signers. So you have to cast your mind back to 1776, which is a new country. And they're trying to figure out how to make themselves real. How do they have legitimacy with other countries? They're trying to get Spain, France to support them and so forth. So Continental Congress thought very carefully about the procedures and protocols that they used to make their documents official, to give them status. So even before the Declaration of Independence, they had developed the habit of signing their resolutions as groups of state delegates. New Hampshire would sign first, and they'd run down the coast until Georgia signed last. And they would put the state labels alongside each group of signers. When they got to the Declaration of Independence, they did two funny things. They signed the document right to left instead of vertically or left to right. So New Hampshire is in the upper right-hand side of the parchment in the National Archives. And they didn't put the state labels there. So already in 1776, they were playing down the role of the state-by-state groupings. But those groupings are still there on that matlack parchment in the National Archives. When we get to this parchment, there are no more state groupings. The names have been completely scrambled up. It's just a list of names. And this seems to be driving home an argument that the Federalists were making in the 1780s, that the new republic rested on the authority of a single united sovereign people rather than resting on the authority of separate state governments.
Emily Sneff, this is a fascinating story. It's also a mystery. What do we know about how this rare document ended up in England?
Well, we have two different hypotheses, and they're incongruous. So the first one is that the parchment made its way to the UK in the 1780s or 1790s. When it was deposited at the West Sussex Record Office 60 years ago, it came in with some papers from the Dukes of Richmond. So if that hypothesis holds water, then it's possible that this document is connected to the third Duke of Richmond called the Radical Duke, and he was a supporter of the American colonies. The wrinkle is that there's an 1836 miniature engraving that's based on this parchment, and that was produced in Boston. So either there's another copy of this parchment that was the basis for that engraving, or the Sussex Declaration didn't move until after 1836, in which case the third Duke of Richmond had already died. So the next course of research for us is really figuring out which of these hypotheses we can get the closest to proving.
Emily Sneff and Danielle Allen of Harvard University, thanks very much for telling us about this.
Thank you. Thank you.
There can be no copy of our final guest on the show today. She is one of a kind. Ja 9 is her name. She's a reggae singer from Jamaica. Here's a track from her latest CD. It's called Unafraid.
Nasty little teacher boy touching on my nephew, stirring up the dragon in my head. Blood bubbling like a boy might have full. Whole of ears as or at least get a page from the dread.
Unafraid could also be a great description for Ja 9 herself. Women have long been eclipsed on the reggae scene by men, but Ja 9 is, shall we say, unafraid to be in that space.
I've found it to be very welcoming. There are still those elements where, you know, they resist it, but I don't think it's a thing particular to reggae music. I think that's just how the world is right now, where women are concerned. Like, it's an intimidating thing to see how much the women are kind of leading the way, and if a man is not necessarily ready to receive that or ready to let go of the old culture, he's going to struggle through it. But it cannot be avoided, because, I mean, for me, I'm a producer as well, so I'm willing to do everything for myself. I have a publishing company, I have a record label, all very small now and just starting, but it just goes to show that there's a different mindset now. We're not looking for somebody to do us favors anymore.
So when you look at yourself and you think about yourself as a musician and the whole landscape of Jamaican music, do you compare yourself to other women, or you just think of the whole picture?
I don't compare myself to anyone. Like, I'm not I can't be 100% sure what anybody else is doing. A lot of it looks really good, and a lot of it sounds really good, and even the consciousness, and then you hear this about whatever, and I'm like, I'm trying not to judge anyone, so I'm just trying to make sure that I'm doing what I am inspired to do.
So let me ask you about one song in particular called Unafraid.
Yes.
And it's about child molestation, and that's not really a theme that comes up a lot, really, in any music, but certainly not in reggae.
True.
What motivated that? What prompted that song?
Well, I mean, it is a taboo issue, and it's not because it's not relevant and very serious. It's just people tend to be afraid to talk about certain things, so it's something that needs to be spoken about, and not in a submissive kind of way, but in a very straightforward, aggressive way to say, we will see you, we will call you out, do not do this, you don't want to have to deal with us.
You're very passionate as you talk about it. Is it personal for you as well, or is it just what you see around you every day?
Fortunately, I am one of the few women that I know who has not experienced sexual abuse. And I say that because, like, I will be at a table with four women, and I am the only woman who didn't have a stepfather or an uncle or somebody who molested them as a child, either one instance or, like, a course of 10 years. And the more I heard about this and heard about it on the news and the human trafficking and the child pornography and all of this, like, it just became more and more necessary that, look, I need to write about this.
To hammer home that point, we'll go out with John Nine's terrific cover of Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, a standard made popular by one of John Nine's heroes, the late Nina Simone.
But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good.
Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
That'll do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
You know, sometimes, baby, I'm so carefree. With a joy that's hard to hide. And then sometimes again it seems that all I have.
PRI, Public Radio International.